Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. It's the Garden Guy Show with Gary Heilig. Welcome back, Gary.
Glad to be here, and spring is coming soon.
That's right. This is the March edition, and as always, we have my sister Sue from Kalamazoo. Welcome, Sue.
I'm glad to be here.
It's always fun to do this show. Sue, would you lead us with a word of prayer?
Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you that spring is coming again to remind us of new life, especially the new life that you give us and you want us to remember so that we can go home and be home with you forever. So help us to remember that as we move into spring and learn new things about how you bring life into our world. In your name, amen.
Amen. Well, Gary, we've had some pretty good quizzes lately, and I see the topic is peaches.
That's right. I think we did onions last month, wasn't it?
That is correct. Yeah.
So the first question is, what do peaches and roses have in common?
I have no idea.
Sue should probably get this one.
Well, I kind of know that one. I think they're in the same family.
That's right. They're Rosaceae.
They sure don't look alike.
Well, when you get to the family level, there's certain morphologies that are the same. For instance, if you look at the construction of the flower, it's a five-petaled flower and various other things that are all common in the rose family.
Well, I definitely wouldn't have got that on a multiple choice quiz.
Well, let's try this one. What country is the number one peach producer on the planet?
I'm going to say the United States.
Okay.
I'm going to say China because it's always China.
It is. And, you know, one of the things about China is with 1.3 billion people, because they're down 100 million after the last census, that's a pretty good guess in a lot of these things. The 1.3 billion people eat a lot of food. Okay, so they're the number one producer. Number two is Spain. Number three is Italy. Number four is Greece. And number five is the USA.
So three of those are in the Mediterranean.
Now, because peaches, although they grow in a temperate area, they will grow in warmer areas as long as they have a certain number of hours below, say, in the 40s and 30s. Now, the next one is, what are the top five producers in the United States in terms of peach production per state?
I'm just going to do the two I can think of is Georgia and Michigan.
Okay. What do you say, Sue?
I'm going to say California because it's so big and it's kind of a Mediterranean climate.
Yep. California's number one.
And I read something somewhere recently that there was like, you know, Georgia's always saying they're the big peach state and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But South Carolina had beaten them.
Yes, South Carolina's number two, then Georgia, then Pennsylvania. And I was surprised by the fifth one, New Jersey. And Michigan,
New Jersey,
and then Michigan falls in at number seven. Now, to give you an idea how different the positions are, California comes in at an annual production of 505,000 tons a year. Michigan's production, being in the number seven spot, was 12,000 tons. And that was in 2022, and their production was up 43% over 2021. So it's a race that being number seven is like you're nowhere in sight of the finish line compared to California. All right, so the next one is, what country's citizens consume the most peaches per capita?
Well, that's got to be China because they're growing the most.
Yep, that's right. China is. But the thing about China is that they prefer the white-fleshed peaches that have a low acid content and tend to be sweeter than what we have here in the United States. We like the yellow-fleshed peaches the most, and they tend to be more acidic.
I like the white ones better.
Well, they're both good. I mean, it depends on your preference. I do like the acidity, especially if I'm making a pie. But that's the way it is. Now, the next one is, what is the sweetest peach?
Well, I'm going to vote for maybe a white peach of some sort.
Tom?
I have no clue.
He's just shaking his head over here. It's called the donut peach. They're also known as Saturn peaches. And this peach tends to be the sweetest because it has the gene for sweetness is called the honey gene. And so when they're trying to breed peaches and they want them to be sweet, they try to make sure that that gene is bred into the peach that they're trying to produce. But the Saturn peach is the peach that you see at the store that looks like somebody crushed it down. It's kind of flattened. And they tend to be sweeter. They also tend to be softer. They have less acidity than the yellow flesh peaches. And so the next one is going to be a little difficult. If you plan on canning your peaches, assuming you grow some, how soon should you do it to keep all of their nutritional value and flavor?
My thought is as soon as possible, but I wonder if it's the ripeness. It always seems like you get peaches, as I remember from Mom doing it, is that they always seem to sit for a couple days before they actually canned them.
Okay.
So I go with Tom's first part of his answer because, you know, like Bird's Eye and all those people, they try to flash freeze stuff as quick as they get it out mm-hmm. of the field. So well, I'm kind of go with it as soon as you can.
Okay. Now, that's not time. I'll make it into a multiple choice question. 24 hours, 36 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours.
24 hours.
What's your guess, Tom?
Well, let's go with 24.
24 would be correct. They did a study at Oregon State University, and they found that if you canned it within 24 hours, it keeps its antioxidants, it keeps its vitamin content high. Actually, vitamin A's and vitamin C and folate actually increased during the canning process. But those levels of nutrients stayed stable for at least 3 months. Hmm. So once they get older, then they start to drop down in their nutrition level.
This is in the canning jar after it's already sealed?
That's when it's canned, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, why would the vitamin C and the folic acid increase? It's like, does it, because it becomes more concentrated through the canning process?
Could be. I'm not really sure why it would increase because that was a question I had too, but I didn't go into doing more research because I probably would have spent hours looking to determine that because I know that vitamin C is a water-soluble vitamin, so it would seem like it would be easier to lose it into the syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Folate is a mineral, I believe. So that, well, I'm not sure. It's better if I just leave that one alone. I'm not sure.
I
could try to do some research. So, yeah, go ahead.
Question for you.
Uh huh.
A friend of mine, they always did this when they canned peaches. They always put one pit in the jar, and they said it improved the flavor. And I kind of think it did.
I don't know if it does or not, but there are some poisons in the pit. And water water tends to be the best solvent. I don't think I would do that. And what I would tell people if they're going to can something, to always go with the Ball Blue Book recommendations. because that's the most up-to-date information on canning technology. And I've never, ever read where you put a peach pit inside. Now, you will sometimes get a pit or a piece of a pit through the processing process, like with a plum or a cherry or something like that. But that's usually by accident. They don't intend to do that. So I wouldn't do it.
So,
Garrett, well, I have heard that there's like cyanide in that little thing in the middle of the pit.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Gary,
in the seed.
You said the latest technology. I mean, canning is as old as the hills.
It has been, but there's still being research done to make sure that it's as safe as possible.
Very good.
They put out a Ball Blue Book every year, and if there's any updates in research, they'll try to include it in there. Okay, the next one, and this is probably an easy one. Who has cultivated peaches the longest?
Well, it's
got to
be China.
It's China.
I mean, they've been growing the most for the longest, yeah. I bet.
And they've been doing it since about 1000 BC. Now, this one, you probably aren't going to get. What does Alexander the Great have to do with peaches?
Well, I'm just going to...
Well, that seems obvious.
He brought it from one place to another.
Yeah, he was always barging around and conquering things.
Yes, he was, but I need more information.
Okay.
That's true.
Well, he found it somewhere and brought it home.
That's right. Where did he find it and where did he take it?
Well, he didn't go to China.
No, he didn't. He discovered them in Persia and took them home to the Greeks. Okay, our next question.
Just remember you learned that here on The Garden Guy.
The next question is, what did the Romans call peaches? Now, the previous question gives you a little bit of a hint.
Well, probably Persian
apples.
Treats or
there
something.
There you go. Persian apples.
Wow. I got one.
Well, both you and Sue got one. So that's what the Romans called them. And now, this next one deals with culinary stuff about peaches, but I think it's kind of interesting. First of all, what is peach melba?
Oh, it's a delicious thing. I have it in a cookbook. It's peaches with over vanilla ice cream with raspberry sauce.
Right. But they are poached peaches, vanilla ice cream, and a raspberry puree. And did you know that this dessert was named after a person named Nellie Melba, who was a great Australian operatic soprano?
Oh.
And there is a peach called Peche de Vigne, which is French, and it's spelled P-E-C-H-E, then D-E, and then V-I-G-N-A. And it's considered one of the finest peaches of all. And it comes from France, and they grow it in vineyards. And it's a small, red-fleshed peach, and it's generally only found there. It's not grown commercially. It's covered with a kind of a grayish, hairy down, as opposed to what we have over here. Not particularly attractive, but the flavor is said to be superb. And the reason I mentioned peach melba is they say it tastes like a combination of peach and raspberry flavor. And I was going to try to order a tree last night, and the only place I could find one that wasn't out of stock was in England. So I don't know if I could just grow one here, because when something comes from another country, it has to go through quarantine, or they have to have agreements on phytosanitary standards.
So I know what a poached egg is, but you said a poached peach. What is a poached peach?
just like an egg, a poached egg is one that is put in hot water. Well, they're actually these, I have a little poaching container, and you crack the egg into this little container, and it's cooked over water. So it's similar in texture to a soft-boiled egg. So it's probably what they do is, and I don't know this for sure, but when you can peaches, you put them in a hot water bath for about 2 to 3 minutes in order to loosen the skin. And that's essentially poaching, but they don't call it that when they're canning. So it's slightly cooked, but not completely cooked.
Very good.
Just very gently simmered.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're not going to cook it all the way through because then it gets softer. But that's what I suspect it is. I've never looked up how to poach a peach, but I suspect that based on poaching eggs, it's similar.
Well, you've been listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig. He's a retired extension agent and loves to grow even after he retired. And so we each month we have here him on Strong Tower Radio. We have Sue Majeure and yours truly, Tom Majeure. After the break, we're going to talk about starting your seeds for the next growing season. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087 on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Gary Heilig, Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I'm Tom Majeure, your host, with co-host Sue Majeure. Gary, we're into March, and it's time to start the seeds. Of course, you've been encouraging us to order our seeds months ago. Now it's time to do it. What can we start in March?
Well, first of all, when you think about how much time we have about 12 weeks before May 31st, which is traditionally that weekend of Memorial Day is when people like to get out and get their garden started. So the minimum you need is 8 to 10 weeks for most people, depending on the quality of the light you have available. If you have a greenhouse, you can get it done like in 6 to 8 weeks. But most people are going to need 8 to 10 weeks, and we have about 12 right now. So in my house, I've already started begonias and gerberas and gazanias, and they're just starting to come up. And it's been, I think, January 26th is when I sowed the begonias. And they are probably less than a millimeter across, so they're really slow to get started. And that's why I started those back in January. But now, what I would think of getting started are things that can be put out fairly early, like in early May, you can start putting out mid-May, early somewhat if you protect them from frost, because if you get a good freeze during the early May time, it'll wipe out just about everything. But lettuce seeds can get started right now. As we get through March, especially toward the end of March, I definitely want to have my onion seeds going. If you haven't started pepper seeds, you need to get them going early March because they take quite a while to get any size to them. Mini perennial, and perennials especially take a little bit longer than a lot of annuals. So if you're going to be growing some perennials, Be sure you read the package to see how much time they suggest you allow before you get those started. Annual seeds like marigolds and those types of things, zinnias, they jump up pretty quickly within just 2 or 3 days. Like I started a couple of tomatoes already and they were up in 3 days, but that was on a heated mat. So if they're not on a heated mat, then you can figure on it's going to be 7 to 10 days, in certain cases even longer. I also had started some asparagus seeds in January. I think I talked about that last time, and they're still not up. So we're going into the second week of February as we record this. So in March, they should be up, but they're not going to be that tall. So if you haven't started asparagus and you want to from seed, you should get that done. Although planting it by crowns is a lot easier, but for those who like to try something different, I'd get those started too.
What about some of the tougher flowers like pansies and violas that can take a little bit of frost?
Yeah, pansies and violas could be started right now as long as you have the lights. And that was one of the things that I wanted to talk about was right now I'm working on a video for YouTube on LED lights. And I am decreasing the amount of time that I'm running my lights. And I primarily have LED lights right now on all of my plants. In the basement, where I have things that normally grow outside during the summer, like my citrus trees and various other ferns and things, those were on 24 hours a day. That's been cut to about half of that. Although it did cause my lemon to start blooming like crazy, I got my light bill and it was $450-something.
Ooh.
And those are the cheapest lights to run. And I think it's more than just the lights because I also had on my seed starting mat, which is probably a power drain. I have to run... do a little study on it and find out how many watts that thing is pulling, because I think that's probably more than the LEDs. But normally I had been able to get my light bill down to just around $200 a month. And I was doing that by getting rid of all of the extraneous things that take power that you don't know that's taking power. Like I have one of those little Amazon globe speakers where I call Alexa and tell her to play something for me. Well, I unplug that when I'm not using it because I don't want them listening in on me. And I turn off the hot water heater unless we're using it. And we do our timing for washing laundry and dishes to late at night. And all those things, I was able to get our bill down from close to 300 to just a little bit above 200. But with those lights running 24 hours a day in the basement, the heating mats and the lights upstairs, it really went up. So even though those LED lights don't cost a lot by themselves, there are other things like the heating mats that can really cut into your electric bill.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. I have what we call a germinating chamber. Actually, the way I do it, is it's an old refrigerator. It's insulated. I can run it with, I have to use an incandescent bulb because the LEDs don't give off sufficient heat, but one 40-watt light bulb. And I also have a temperature probe that will cut off the light when the temperature, we're controlling the temperature range.
Mm-hmm.
What is lights for germination? What is lights versus heat? I've got a germination chamber. What you're talking about a heat mat. Which do you use? Which combination? Light only, heat mats?
Well, the heat mat tends to raise up the soil temperature within a range where seeds will germinate quickly. But it'll also provide some heat in that refrigerator if you wanted to use it that way. But incandescent lights do give off more heat than fluorescent and LEDs. You don't get much from the LEDs. I do have some LEDs that look sort of like floodlights. They're kind of different. And they do give off a little bit more heat, but they're so far away from the plants, it's negligible. Because they're like a floodlight, you can have it up higher.
So when does heat is more important than light? Until it germinates, heat is more important than what?
No, not necessarily. What heat? When you can apply heat to something, you can put it right in the ideal range for that particular seed. Especially with vegetables, they know that most vegetables like to be in the 80 degrees Fahrenheit range. Now, light, the most important light for seed germination is red light. And in one of my LEDs, you can adjust that. So you can just put on the red light or a combination of red and white light and not use the blue light at all. But once it's up, then the blue light helps the greenery to grow. So light is important, especially for certain seeds, like lettuce, for instance, needs red and far red light in order to germinate. And that's why we don't bury those seeds very far. They're really close to the surface, so they can take advantage of that light. And it's a real complicated chemical process as to what the red light does.
So in my germination chamber, as soon as it pops up, it doesn't have significant light in there. It's got to hit the light and get to go to the grow lights?
Yeah, what'll happen if you just leave it under the incandescent light, it doesn't have the right spectrum for plant growth. So what happens is you tend to get stretched seedlings.
I've seen that.
So, and also the incandescent light intensity is very low. And that's also causes them to stretch because what the cells will do is elongate so that the plant can stretch closer to the light, and that produces a weaker seedling. If you're using lights that have the full sunlight spectrum and they're really close to the seedlings, which increases the intensity of the light, then you tend to have more short, stout seedlings, which is what you want. Weak seedlings break easily, and that can be a problem when you get them out in the garden.
So what else do, what other factors do we need to consider in starting our March seeds?
Well, I always, and I think I said this last month, be sure to read all of the label directions, because especially when you get into some of the flowers, it's not just a matter of putting them in the ground. You need to know whether it needs to be at ground level or how deep to plant it. You need to know, does it require any particular temperature regime? Because some seeds have to go through a cold treatment before they get started. Some need a warm treatment before they get started. Some need a combination of warm and cold in order for them to germinate. And all of those things are important. And if you're starting other seeds, like say, for instance, some person that wants to say, start an apple tree from seed, which I don't necessarily recommend because it won't be true to the parent that you had. But some seeds require a treatment of the coat. It might be abrading the seed coat. It might be soaking them in an acid for a very short period of time, like a half hour, in order to start that process of breaking down the outer seed coat so that it will aid germination. So there are lots of different things. And with the internet, you can have good success if you look up what's the best way to germinate a particular type of seed.
I'm going to, I placed my last seed order. It was just probably about 6 or 8 seeds. And the shipping cost was a significant percentage because I couldn't get, I had to go to 2 different vendors, and I chose not to do the third because the shipping costs would be equal to the seeds.
Oh, I had shipping costs that cost more than the seeds.
So how do you beat the system?
You really can't, Tom.
Okay.
Well, all I could suggest you do is shop around because, like I said, I had some seeds that were about $5 a pack, but shipping was $7. And you have to ask yourself, how badly do you want it for that? Now, some of the seeds I ordered anyway because I'm trying new varieties and I'll do reports on my YouTube channel and that type of stuff. And actually, those are, you know, that's a tax write-off for me if I remember to keep their information, which I just thought of. But anyway, yeah, you have to ask yourself, is it worth it because of the shipping cost?
So what I'm, there was one seed I couldn't get from, I'd have to go to one vendor. It was as much as the seed package. So I'm going to go to pick it up at a local place.
Yeah, I mean, there are many, many different seeds you can get locally, which shipping is just you driving to the store and buying it. But they're much more reasonably priced. But if you're looking for the latest varieties, award-winning varieties, heirlooms that are not well known, then like when I talked about that heirloom peach, you just have to order them, because you may look all over the United States and sometimes all over the world. There's a seed that I've been trying to get, which is a, and I think I've talked about, a paprika that they grow over in Hungary only, and I can never get the seed because they sell out so quickly. But I'm sure the shipping is going to kill me.
Okay, let's turn a corner. We've been going through the various soil science and plant nutrition. This month is manganese.
There's magnesium and then there's manganese. They're two different things. And manganese is what we call a micronutrient, which means it needs very small amounts compared to, say, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And in terms of the micronutrients, it's just behind iron in terms of what plants need. And if it doesn't get enough, it'll be deficient. If there's too much, it can cause a toxicity. And what it actually does is, manganese is essential for photosynthesis. It helps the plant to take up nitrogen. It's also needed for a process called respiration, and we're not going to get into all the details. There's transpiration, respiration, and photosynthesis. Those are three big metabolic processes in plants. Maybe in the future we can talk about it. Like transpiration, I like to call it plant sweat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
'Cause they have to get rid of different things. But respiration deals with gas exchange. And we'll talk about that some other time. But it's also very important for fertilization, because manganese is needed to help the pollen germinate. And the pollen will germinate on the female part of the flower, send its genetic material down the pollen tube, and then the process of fruit and seed production goes on. So if you don't have manganese, that doesn't happen. Also, remember when we talked about cell elongation, mm-hmm. where plants stretch up to the light? Well, manganese is necessary for that process of cell elongation. And also, it helps the plant to be more resistant to various pathogens that might attack the plant from the root. So it has some very important roles. And a deficiency will generally develop, a manganese deficiency will develop when the pH starts to get high. In other words, when you're above 6.5. And it looks very similar to iron deficiencies in that it's kind of like a light green leaf, dark green veins. And there's some other things you look for that deficiency. So most people want to know, well, what do I do about it? And you're more likely to see a manganese deficiency in a potted plant than you will in the ground, especially if you have been using liquid fertilizers like Miracle-Gro or Rapid Grow, which has micronutrients in it. But in some of the commercial potting mixes, they have just enough of some of these micronutrients to last about a week. And if they don't get any, and say, for instance, you use the same pot year after year with the same soil, then these deficiencies can start to show up. Now, the way that people get manganese onto the plant is through chelated manganese, which is the form that you'd find in the Miracle-Gro or the Rapid-Gro, and you spray it on the leaves. or a process called a material called manganese sulfate, which you can buy at local garden centers or Amazon. But I would strongly suggest you run a soil test first to see if you need manganese. And secondly, if you do, follow the soil test results or the label directions on the container, because if you give it too much, you will have some problems. Because manganese is very soluble, and toxicity symptoms can show up pretty quickly, especially if you're growing geraniums or a flower called lithianthus or New Guinea impatiens. And again, you'd more likely get a toxicity if you were adding too much manganese to a container. So be sure you run that soil test.
Very good. Sure appreciate that, Gary. Listeners, you're hearing Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. We'll be back after this break.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you, and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
Three, two, one. The Garden Guy is back with Sue and Tom Majeure, and today now we're going to talk about blueberries. What's there not to like about blueberries?
I can think of at least three or four things that I have them in your garden.
All right, let's hear it, Sue.
Well, one, I love the blueberries, and they're very healthy for you.
Yes, they are. They contain vitamin E, vitamin 6, copper, vitamin C, manganese, and vitamin K.
Anthocyanins?
Yeah, definitely. It's the color of it gives you antioxidants also. So it's a good thing to have around. What else?
Two, they have beautiful crimson leaves in the fall.
Yeah, if you have a euonymus in your yard, it looks very similar to euonymus. Beautiful bright red. And in the spring, they have these little bell-shaped flowers that are really nice. And when the green leaves are out, they're nice and dark green, assuming that they're healthy plants. And with the contrast white of white flowers, and later the blueberries with the bloom on it, waxy bloom, it's a very beautiful plant to have in the landscape.
I think it's great, and now this is not a popular reason, but you probably would get some beautiful, beautiful cedar wax wings.
Not only those, but also eastern bluebirds love blueberries. And I think I've mentioned on our program before that before we put netting around our blueberries, we practically got no blueberries because the birds enjoyed them. And, I mean, they picked them clean. We had five bushes that were just full of blueberries once we covered them over with netting. Of course, the birds didn't appreciate it very much. But there's nothing that could that would stop you from using it as an ornamental in your landscape as a bird feeding station if you wanted, because you don't really even need to spray them if you're using it as a bird feeding station, because the insects aren't a problem for the birds. You just may want to watch out for diseases and just prune off any disease stuff that's there. But they're just a really nice plant to have around. And if you've ever had dried blueberries, I call them blueberry raisins, you really get the real flavor of a blueberry when its flavor is concentrated as a dried fruit. And the first time I had them was at a fruit and vegetable show in Grand Rapids. It was the Great Lakes Fruit and Vegetable Show, and they sold dried blueberries there. And they're just a great snack.
Well, I like them frozen. Frozen blueberries are like candy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I never tasted a blueberry till I was an adult.
Really?
It just wasn't. Up in the Saginaw area, there weren't a lot of blueberry farms. Most of the blueberry farms in the southwest part of Michigan, you need certain types of soils to grow the best blueberries. Otherwise, it becomes a little bit more of a chore, but it's not impossible. But when I got down to the Lansing area, there were more soils that were adaptable to blueberries, and we used to go pick blueberries every summer. So now blueberries are ranked number one in terms of having antioxidants and various health benefits of the more than 40 fresh fruits and vegetables. So it's a pretty interesting plant. It is native to North America. It's one of the few, if not only commercially available, fruits native to North America. Like people would say, what about strawberries? Well, strawberries are native to South America. And we do have alpine.
Cranberries?
Yeah, we do have cranberries here. And I don't know what their range is, but we do have alpine strawberries too, but they're nothing like the strawberries that you buy commercially. They're actually crosses. But a single blueberry plant, a high bush blueberry plant, can produce up to 6,000 blueberries a year. That's a lot of bird snacks. And the consumption of blueberries has been linked to health benefits, including reduced risk of cancer, increased insulin response, reversal in, I won't say reversal, but helping with age-related memory loss and lowering blood pressure, which, I mean, if you eat a diet that's high in fruits and vegetables, you're going to get those benefits anyway. And they're fairly easy to grow. Of all the different fruits, they probably have the least number of pest problems. Some of them are fairly serious that have to be dealt with, but it's not a long list like apples. If you look at the spray guides for apple trees, it's just page after page of all the things that like to eat your apples, and that list is much shorter with blueberries.
So, how often do you have to make sure there's enough acid in the soil? Because they like acid soil, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They like to have a pH between 4.5 and 5.5, which is on the acidic end of the pH scale. Ideally, you want to lower that about a year before you're going to plant your blueberries. But as you're using acidifying fertilizers, you can drive it down over time. And you can put some sulfur or iron sulfate around the plants. You just can't overdo it because of what happens to sulfur in the soil. It's converted by the bacteria to sulfuric acid. And too much of that around the root system can be a problem for the plants. But you can add some and lower it down if you haven't done it up front. So yes, they do prefer acidic conditions. And one of the reasons for that is they like iron, and iron is most available at the lower pHs. Now, they like a lighter textured soil. They do like a fairly high water table, but they don't like sitting in water, at least not the cultivated varieties. You will find blueberries growing on the edge of bogs in Michigan. And the kind of blueberries you normally find in Michigan, you'd be up around Clare. They're called low bush blueberries. Those are the wild blueberries. And then the ones we grow are called high bush, which just simply means they get much taller. If you just let them grow, they'll get about 6-7 feet high. We normally try to keep them around 4 to 5 feet high.
So you say light soils. Does that mean sand, or does it mean something else?
Sandy loam soils are pretty good, but you don't want pure sand. They like organic matter. So one of the ways people add organic matter is they will mulch with various type of organic mulches like pine needles or wood, shredded wood bark and that type of stuff. And then they just leave it there. And then as that material decomposes, the worms will start to mix it in. And the blueberries absolutely love that. So they are kind of special in that they prefer acidifying fertilizer. So if a fertilizer has sulfate after it, like potassium sulfate or ammonium sulfate, those types of things, those are the kind of fertilizers that blueberries like. They don't respond real well to like ammonium nitrate and potassium chloride, which is what you find in most of your mixes. And they're easy to deal with in terms of pruning. If you can prune a lilac properly, you can prune a blueberry. On my YouTube channel, I do have a pruning video where some people had some mature blueberries that hadn't been pruned in a while, and I did some pruning. But if you watch either my lilac video or the blueberry video, you'll get the basics of how to prune them. And we try to keep them at a size that's manageable. So you want to keep them about 5 feet or less. So what you end up doing is you take out the really old stuff, which then encourages new things to come up. And then I won't talk about pruning them here because I just kind of wave my hands in the air. People can't really see what I'm talking about. It's radio.
That's right. That's right.
Normally I have PowerPoint presentations and videos for those types of things.
I feel lucky that I've gotten to eat some of those wild blueberries. We were camping and we picked them and put them in our pancakes.
Yeah, and the blueberries that you find in like blueberry mixes, those are the wild blueberries. They tend to be smaller because some of the cultivated varieties can be as large as a nickel. And that's a large blueberry to put in muffins or pancakes. I mean, you can do it, but I've seen some that has gotten almost as large as a quarter. So I don't particularly care for them. When I select varieties, I'm looking for flavor. And so there is information online, like recommended blueberry varieties for Michigan. There is a website, it's called Michigan Blueberry Facts, and it shows you things like different types of fruit rots that can happen. For most homeowners, there's only about three or four things that you really have to be concerned about, and they're not that serious in a home planting because we don't have a lot of blueberries in mid-Michigan, so the diseases aren't as high a pressure problem as they would be in a big blueberry growing area. And the insects that you have to deal with are basically maggots. One is blueberry maggot, which is very similar to the apple maggot and the cherry maggot, and that spotted wing Drosophila we've talked about before, which is the maggot of a fruit fly. But those are fairly easy to deal with, both organically and using conventional material. So it's no reason not to use them. Now, if you're not good about getting out there and treating things when you need to, then you're going to be eating maggots. And that's just not going to make you happy.
No, I don't care for that type of protein.
No, you wouldn't notice it in most cases, but if you weren't looking for it. But, you know, we're just kind of icky here in the United States about eating maggots.
What about protection of these blueberries? Are we talking about frost, or what kind of protection are we talking about?
Well, actually, they're pretty resistant to frost. Of all of the fruits that I have growing, I've grown strawberries and cherries and apples and pears and peaches and plums, nectarines, apricots, blueberries, raspberries. The ones that tend to get hurt the least are the blueberries. I think part of that is the timing of when they flower, because when they're dormant, they can handle colder weather. And they're just more resistant. So in years where I even lost apples, I still had blueberries. And apples are kind of hard to kill off too. But the big threat is to your berries from birds. And the only way you can stop that is to either use a net, which is pretty effective. Or there are, I've talked about this in the past, protecting your cherries using three things. Grape Kool-Aid, which is unsweetened Kool-Aid. Also using those streamers, they're Mylar streams, the red on one side and silver on the other, and those big predator eye balloons, the yellow ones with the big eyes on them. You hang it over the blueberries, and those three things will do a good job of keeping them off. Especially if you get the Kool-Aid on early, before they actually start feeding. Birds don't like the flavor of grape Kool-Aid.
So you've shared that with us before, but what's the secret formula? What's the concentration?
It's just one package to a gallon of water, and you don't put sugar in it, and you just spray it on before they start doing their thing. If you get a lot of rain, like half inch of rain, you may have to reapply it, but I've rarely had to reapply more than twice in a season. Now, that depends too. Blueberries will start to be harvested in mid-July, and they, depending on your variety, they can be harvested into September, so you'll have to spray to protect them depending on what varieties you have.
So how far in advance is it? Just when the bear or the fruit comes out,
or? When you start seeing the berries turn, the first one starting to turn blue, that's when their birds are going to come and pick them off. So you want to have it on just as they're beginning to do that. And I haven't used it on my blueberries because I use netting, but I've used it on cherries, and it does a really effective job, those three things together. It's quite surprising. And commercially, they have bird repellents, and the active ingredient is methyl anthranilate, which is artificial grape flavoring. And it doesn't affect the flavor of the blueberries. It just washes right off.
I'm just curious.
So does this mean you don't have a can in your yard, Gary?
No. Well, out where I live, it probably wouldn't be a problem. In a lot of places, people would get upset hearing those cannons go off every few seconds. I do know some blueberry growers in the Lansing area that use those cannons, and they go off about every 30 seconds or so to scare the birds. They're somewhat effective, but it can ruin your neighbor's good feelings towards you.
You know, down in South Haven, when we used to go out and pick, you'd be picking, you'd hear those things going off like crazy.
It probably sounded like a battlefield down there. But they have a lot of blueberries, though, and probably not enough birds to eat all of them. But anything that they're eating is decreasing their return on their investment. So that's why they do that. Because birds can eat a lot of blueberries.
So what about
those machines, too, that they use for picking them are kind of amazing.
Yeah, they go right over the bushes and shake them right off.
Well, they look like a giant broomstick eating machine or something.
Yeah, it actually kind of reminds me of some of the car washes that go over the top of your car,
but
they
have
these little flailing arms that knock all the blueberries off. It's quite amazing, but it's a very intensive job to pick blueberries, especially when you see the scale in which they're grown in some areas. So automation really makes a big difference in terms of not having to worry about getting labor.
So what about harvest time and yield?
Well, as I said, harvest time starts in July, goes into September. Normally, people will start picking when about a third of the berries have turned blue, and you'll be harvesting multiple times. And blueberries don't have to be refrigerated right away. They will be a little bit more resistant to breaking down very quickly. I mean, they can sit on the counter for 2 or 3 days and they'll pretty much look the same, whereas you could never do that with a raspberry or strawberry. And if you're going to harvest them, pick them early in the morning so that there's not as much field heat in them. And processing them is pretty easy. I mean, we can freeze them. There's not much to it. Normally, we don't add sugar, but you can add a little sugar to them if you want. Put them in freezer bags. You don't have to blanch or anything like that. You can blueberries. You can also, we like to freeze them. And you can also dry them and have your little blueberry raisins.
Do you wash them before you freeze them or wash them after?
Yeah, I would wash them before.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Well,
if you do that, isn't it a matter of if you wash that bloom off, then you have to dry them on a cookie sheet or something, or they clump. But if you freeze them with the bloom on, they don't stick together.
Well, what you can do is put them on a tray and then semi-freeze them, and then if any of them stick together, just break them up when you put them in the bag. As you put them in the bag.
Very good.
It's very easy to deal with.
Boy, I'm really hungry after all this tasty stuff.
Very good. Well, you've been listening to it. Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeur, and Tom Majeur. We hope that you've enjoyed and are looking forward to your growing season. Until next month, this is Strong Tower Radio. Bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to Strong Tower Radio Network. Our stations reach from Kalamazoo over to Lansing and up to the Mackinac Bridge and then west to Ironwood on the border of Wisconsin and even a station in central Illinois. Our most southerly station is 97.3 W247 AM Kalamazoo. Driving north on 131, you can tune to 91.9 WMJC in Richland. Continuing north on 131, you can tune to 89.7 WNHG Grand Rapids. Driving west from Grand Rapids, you can tune to 93.1 WMPA Ferrisburg. Driving north from Grand Rapids, you can continue to listen to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 91.9 FM WGCP Cadillac. Driving east from Grand Rapids to Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 1540 AM KTGG Okemos and 104.7 W284 AH Lansing, as well as 92.3 W222 CU Charlotte. Driving north from Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 90.7 FM WBHL Harrison. Continuing your drive north, you can keep listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 93.9 FM WAVC Mayo and 102.7 FM W274BN Alpena. Crossing over the beautiful Mackinac Bridge, you can hear Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 97.9 WIHC Newberry. Driving west of Newberry, Strong Tower Radio can be received by tuning to WUPJ Escanaba on 90.9 FM. Driving further west, tune to 91.3 FM W217CG Ironwood. And lastly, in the heart of the land of Lincoln, tune to Strong Tower Radio on 91.3 FM W217BB Hickory Point. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.